Our regular speaker, Mike, could not make it tonight, but filling in will be Denise, who has been in of service to this group for many years, and I would like to hear about her experience living with the solution in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Wow. So I present Denise.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Denise. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Denise.
You know, I've been chairing this meeting for a while. I've never been in this seat before, you know? So I should have set the thing for like 10 minutes, right? And we could have meditated for a while. That's my comfort zone, right? So we all have, you know, it's like amazing. You know, I've been sober now 10 years, and it's amazing how, you know, we find different avenues in order. One of my big issues, I think, was like reacting. So, like, I just did not know how to react with people. I didn't know how to talk with people. I didn't know how to conversate. I didn't know how to have relationships. I would always get a knot stuck in my throat. Trying to tell somebody anything, I was like, I was going to have a panic attack, you know? That uncomfortability I just experienced just a number of days ago, and it's not like it used to be. I've had to really work hard on communicating. I've had to really work hard, because when I came in, I was like a repeater gun or something. I wouldn't stop. And I didn't know how to. And I was so needy with people that I wanted to eat them up. And like, I would just get louder and louder and louder and louder and louder and louder. And it was scary for people. And, you know, I found a program. I found the steps. I found a good sponsor. I found a network. I found yoga. You know, I started to find calmness, and I started to find some peace and serenity. And you know, it just, like, it follows. It comes. I keep working on things because things crop up all the time, and I'm just not sure exactly. You know, I never get real comfortable because there's so much to work on. I mean, it's never. I can say this is an endless process, and I'll go on for a really long time, and everything I do has to do about my recovery, no matter what I do. Yoga, if I'm going shopping, if I'm going to my family's, everything is surrounded by my recovery. Because if I'm in good spot, then I can normally, you know, generate goodness, kindness, tolerance, patience, everything that I learn in this book. So I was really sorry to hear about Mike. We don't know exactly the extent of everything, but I'm going to just start the book the way I would present it with somebody. And although mine says $5, I always show this first page just to say, you know, this is where we start. You know nothing, and that's the process that we begin with so that we clear our minds. That's like the set-aside prayer. We come in and we just set everything aside. We let God enter and show us the way of what we need to know and process. And we learn about each other. We learn about ourselves as long as we let it come. So so this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know nothing, right? So the first promise, I need my glasses now. So the first promise is that we have recovered from alcoholism, and that's on the first page. Restored to health by having symptoms of illness removed. And that's what that means, is being recovered. I have written here that this is an infectious program. It sort of like just gets you, you know, like every time you come, just gets more and more and more, and then you're passing it on. Like, oh, I learned. Did you hear? Did you go to that meeting? Did you hear what they said? Oh, my God, I heard this guy. Like, oh, it's so great. You know, like, how many phone calls have I had about that? And, you know, this is my, like I said, that I have 10 years, but it took me a long time to get here because, you know, I would say that I was out there for a good 34 years. I was 52 when I came in, so I had tried previously from 1985, and You know, it was like I never lost anything that I got from AA. I just couldn't seem to stay stuck. I didn't know how to do that. And, you know, until this time around. And I'm really grateful for that because, you know, I couldn't even imagine what it would be like today to be out there. My worst day, like, couldn't even, like, being imaginable if I wasn't in AA, you know? So, anyway, we have a lot of chapters in here, but the preface starts with that this is the fourth edition, you know. I think I have the second and third at home because I went around. I could never find the first. I went around and tried to find them. But this is in the book it says that this is our basic text. So when you first come in, a person might say to you, don't read it like it's a novel, you know, because it's not. It really is a textbook. And there was a group of people that were associated with Bill W. and Dr. Bob that sat down and wrote, you know, like the good and the bad, and, you know, came out with, you know, this this writing in order, what they learned and how they stayed sober in order for them to be able to help somebody else. And there weren't, it says in here that there's men and women. There weren't a lot of women around, but there were a lot of closet women, I would probably imagine, even back then, drinking and just, you know, not being able to come out into this man's world. And so it was primarily men. So the great doctor that is presented in Alcoholics Anonymous is Dr. William Silkworth. And he was in Townsend Hospital, and he has a big history with AA and the treatment of alcoholism. And then upon meeting, you know, the first three people in AA, you know, that he really, you know, started the movement of medical being, you know, joined with AA because it's a very difficult, as we know, we're in it, right? It's a very difficult disease to define. Our behaviors are all different. Nobody is alike. The circumstances in our life take us in different directions, so it gives us different aspects of the disease that show up at different times. Our maturity level has a lot to do with it. I think, you know, basically, I mean, I was not a very mature person when I first came in here. I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it, and that was it. And I only knew about myself because, you know, in my brain, that's what I was always thinking about. I always thought I was thinking of you, but it was really, what are they thinking of me? You know, how am I doing? Do they like me? I mean, I can't tell you how many times, I would say when I'm coming into here, when is this going to stop? And one of the things that my sponsor had said to me, because I would call her and tell her all this crap that was going on in my head, and she would say to me, well, you know, like, where would you rather be, in the Bahamas, or, you know? And she was right. You know, I had to think, you know, like, I want to think of better things. I don't want to think of all this garbage that my head wants to think about. So I had to really train myself to go a different direction. The other thing was that was a big thing for me to hear from her was, you know, our aura. That seemingly we could be putting out to people that we don't realize that we're putting out to them. So it shows whether we're interested in them or not interested in them, how kind we are, how tolerant we are. I mean, it really shows how we're respectful towards people and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes, because my mind would take me on another journey, I wasn't so attentive to realize that I could be putting people off due to that very aspect of my personality. So that was really a critical thing for me to really start to look at as I was getting sober, how I was affecting others and, you know, what was I doing in order to help others? And, you know, getting over that hump that it's really not about me. You know, when I first came in, I mean, honestly, it really wasn't about God for me. I knew that I was missing that component because I had tried and tried and tried. And I met these women. I actually met these women by going to this meeting, and I knew it was on Chestnut Street in Union at such and such a time, but I didn't know where it was, and it was at somebody's house, or it was at somebody. So I'm like, it was when they had the time change, so I was like totally screwed up because I'm like an hour early or whatever, and I'm just like looking, and then I called the police department, I called AA, nobody knows anything about this, and I'm just trying to find this meeting so that I could get on this spiritual journey, because I heard that this meeting had it, you know? And so it was like about an hour later, because I went home, I did all these phone calls and, you know, looked up on the computer, had no idea, and I went out an hour later. And then I saw this lady walking down the street, and I stopped her. I said, "You're not going to that AA meeting, are you?" And she had no idea what I was talking about, but she said, "No, I'm not," you know. And then I saw some of these cars, like, going into this driveway. I'm like, that's the ticket. Right? So I walked into that meeting. They became my network after, you know, a number of months. They showed me yoga, introduced me to yoga, and a journey of calm started, and a journey of God started, and AA started. I was no longer out. I was in, you know. We used to have a running joke about that. You're either in or you're out. In or you're out, you know, and if you don't get involved, you don't do this, you don't do that, not in. Got to be in, all fours, in, you know. And so I knew that I was on my way to recovery, and, you know, that was a godsend, that was a blessing, that was grace. So I know I got off track a little bit, but, you know, it's my story, right? Right, so... So the foreword to the first edition is precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So when you pick up this book, that's what we're going to learn. We're going to learn about God. We're going to learn about all the aspects of alcoholism, our behaviors. One of the best chapters that I know in this book is to the two wives. It tells you more about your behavior as an alcoholic than any other chapter in this book. It tells how we treated people and how we treated ourselves and especially how we treated others. Amazing. So I had a meeting that I used to go to before I joined this meeting, and those were the two meetings that really helped me the most. It was one where you took all the considerations and questions, changed them into questions, and went word by word, paragraph by paragraph, chapter by chapter. I mean, it was, you could do like two sentences, and that's what you were discussing that night. And it was a journey, because it took 3 years for me to go through this whole entire book with that group. And I learned a lot about some of the things that when I would go to a meeting that you would just read and everybody would read, but then you just wouldn't discuss, and it was never really actually discussed. So you wouldn't really get the definition and the full effect of what this disease does to us and to others. And because, you know, we come in here and, you know, we have a very bad problem with alcohol, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's not about alcohol anymore. It's all about how our mind works, this obsessive thinking that we have, and how sometimes we can't stop it, and the self-centeredness and the fear that drives me, you know, to avoid you, to go the other way, to make all sorts of excuses, to blame you for everything, make sure that I'm, like, at the top of the list and you're coming in last. And, you know, it's... I don't even know how to say it, but it's a long journey because we need to really pay attention and be vigilant. You know, I've done other, you know, works outside of, you know, the big book, which really helped me. And it's, you know, it suggested that, you know, I know AA conference approved and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, whatever's going to help you, if you need to go to a doctor, you go to a doctor. if you need, you know, I found that exercise really helped me a lot, and it probably was because of the endorphins, and that put me in a better space in my mind, and it made my body move, and therefore I was a happier person. So I was able to, you know, like react in a different fashion than if I'm just immobile and, you know, in my own thoughts. So all of these things, whatever you have to do, I suggest doing anything and everything that you can. And that's why I say, like, my life was all about recovery. So if I went to yoga, I went to yoga for recovery. There's a whole thing all about recovery and the similarities of yoga. You know, they have where, you know, you do service. If you go someplace, you're doing service. You know, they have their own beliefs. There's also another book that I read, which was The Four Agreements, which helped me to take upon myself to re-look and visit my beliefs. Not just say, okay, traditionally that's what belongs to my family, this is what they taught me, this is how the church taught me, this is, now what are mine? Because now I have to start redirecting my own thoughts in order for me to get better. And that's what I learned in AA, that AA gives me the solution, but it's up to me to carry the ball and run. So, so I'm going to start with the doctor's opinion. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from the medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and the witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. And so this is the letter from Dr. Silkworth. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In the late 1934, I attended a patient who was Bill W., who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of this third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well be remedied for thousands of such situations. You must rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Which I have highlighted there because, well, you should see this book. This is really highlighted. But there's a statement in this book that, you know, when we get sober, honesty is like our main, one of our main components. And we find that it's not like being right or wrong, you know. I mean, we like being right, but it's not the important factor. The honesty level is the important factor. And what I learned also is that, you know, we have different levels of honesty. One day, you know, I see it this way. The next day, I see it this way. Maybe 2 days later, I see it another way, and I'm, like, willing to take a look at it a different way because my knowledge has broadened. My search and seeking, just as, you know, we seek for God, we seek for the answers we seek. So just as, like, my seeking has enlarged, then also my level of honesty has enlarged. So I'm able to see something that I wasn't able to see the day before, the next day. And so now I'm able to evaluate that and where that sits in my life. And then I'm able to, you know, think about it, maybe act on it, maybe not. It all depends on the situation at hand. But the awareness is what is the most important thing. Because now we have a level of honesty where we have more of a willingness because we see more of the truth of what we're seeking. So, you know, so when they said this, and in that other statement, I'm not exactly sure where it is in the book, but, you know, they do talk about alcoholics and how honest that they are, and you can trust on them if they're telling you something. And it's so very true. I mean, I see in so many of my situations that I have going on today, like, it bothers me if I'm not honest. I mean, even a little white lie is just, you know, and what happens is, so here comes the right and the wrong. Like, it really doesn't matter if I'm right. Like, I'll let you be right because my health depends on me being straight and forward with what's going on in my life. Because I'm the one that has the problem, and I'm the one that could possibly pick up a drink. It's not them. So I always have to remember that's like the absolute bottom line for me is let them be right, great, fantastic, because my sobriety is more important to me. So no matter what happens in my life today, my sobriety is the most important thing, and I have to protect that with my life. I have to protect that. Nobody else has to. People can step on my toes and, like, you know, whatever they have to do. And I have to be calm, patient, kind, tolerant, all of that stuff that we read all about all the time. You know, sometimes I'm going to say we're not always there, but we're aware of it. That's the difference. We are aware of it. And that's what makes us really, you know, good alcoholics. Like, we're healthy with ourselves because we realize this is our journey. Nobody else in the world has to do that. The average person out there can lie, cheat, and steal, may not bother them at all. But if I lie, steal, and cheat, oh my, whew, I'm going to have a bad night. I might have a bad week. I might not think, if I do something and I say something and it's like really off color, I'm thinking about that for a day, 2 days. It depends on my level of awareness because I need to go to that person and I need to straighten it out. Because it's just it's not good for me. It'll kill me. It'll, you know, it grows. It becomes a resentment. It's, you know, we learn all about this stuff, but, and I know that I've seen a lot of you and you're all very aware of all of this, so I'm not telling you anything new here, you know? And nothing I'm saying, you can see I'm reading from the book, you know? So the physician, at our request, gave us this letter, has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. None of us wanted to hear that one. I mean, I'm like, what are they talking about? I'm smart, you know? It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life. I mean, another one, maladjusted. Who wants to hear that? I'm not maladjusted. You know, everybody else is, not me. You know, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. Another one. I mean, how can you call me a defective? I mean, you know, this is insulting. I'm not reading this book. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, meaning, you know, the welfare of others, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who's very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain, before he is cleared, he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So, like, on something like this, you know, I was in a number of rehabs and a number of aftercare and you know, went on the journey. My first institution. It was by a judge decided that that would be my vacation spot for, you know, 30 days, and you know, it was either that or, you know, a jail. So I figured like that was what I needed to do, right? And but I didn't even know this judge, you know, and this is what he did for me, and it was my first offense. So when I look back at that, I realize that, you know, he knew more about me than I knew about myself. And he knew that there was a possibility that I may be a very sick person and that I may have a problem coming up in the future. And, you know, I didn't respect him because he, like, put me, you know, but I tried to stay away from that court, but I got stuck again on another DWI, and, you know, that was another 30 days someplace. So, you know, I have to say, it wasn't me that wanted to get better. You know, I was introduced to this because somebody thought that I needed to get better, and they needed to send me someplace before I got worse. You know, so Dr. Silkworth here is really an example of how he was able to help a lot of alcoholics that we didn't have the willingness, we didn't know how to help ourselves, and potentially we were alcoholic, but maybe not quite full blown. But we were getting there, and we didn't know any different, because all we knew was we liked that bottle or that drug. So the subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcohol addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction, Towns Hospital. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, if they could only see us now, right? Our scientific approach for everything, we were perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. So with that, they're saying it's not just a physical disease. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients, and with some misgiving, we consented. Cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholic back from the gates of death. That's such a beautiful paragraph. You know, the unselfishness we carry as alcoholics. We go and we try to help somebody else. We do 12-step work all the time. We're always trying to carry the message. The absence of profit. I mean, we don't take money for this. We don't ask for somebody to give us any presents or gifts in order for us to help them. And the community spirit. I mean, when we come walking in this room, I mean, I feel so comfortable when I come into an AA meeting. When I go to a party out there, I'm not like, who's going to be here? What do I have to do? How do I have to dress? I mean, you know, it's and I come in here, and there's just love and warmth, you know, and I'm accepted just for who I am. I don't have to do anything. I can sit down. I don't have to really say anything if I'm not feeling good. People just accept me for who I am. So, I mean, it's great. And then they're indeed inspiring who has labored long and wearily in the alcoholic field. So for him to say that he actually sees that in our community is such an, like, you know, it's just a compliment that this is what the doctor saw. Like, when he saw somebody start to get better, these are the components that would be brought out in somebody that they would get better, and they would become what our love and tolerance is, our code. And that would start to happen just naturally, because that's our natural disposition, and we just go towards it. Just like honesty is really our natural disposition, to be honest. And it makes us feel the most comfortable, so that's where we try to go. I mean, and that's what I find in my recovery, is these things that I learn, if I practice them, I'm not used to, see, we're not used to doing this, but when we practice them, then we find out that's a really, that's our comfortability zone. So, and then still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death, because we all know that it's either, you know, death institution or, what's the last one?
Jail.
Right. So I've been in both of them, but yeah. So, of course, right, not that one yet, right. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be forced, freed from his physical craving for liquor. And this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be maximum benefit. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These alcoholic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. You know, I have to be honest with you. When I first, you know, was introduced to this book, I mean, these paragraphs were really hard to understand. And they're not so hard anymore, you know, because of that meeting I went to. I mean, it pulls it apart, takes it apart, and for you to understand it, you know, how the manifestation of the allergy, you know, occurs in our body. You know, the craving that's in the center of the brain, you know, once we induce alcohol into our body, then it becomes a component, and we need to keep on replenishing that. You know, I know for myself, I mean, I quit smoking a year after I came in, and I used a book, but the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous was still in me, because, you know, it was the triggers. I had to watch for all those triggers, which would make me sensitive to go for a drink, which make me sensitive to go for a cigarette. So, you know, it's like recognizing these things that we have inside of ourselves that makes this easier. So that craving, Once we you know, induce the alcohol into our body, then it creates, like, you have to regenerate it all the time. Like, it's like a cigarette. You have it an hour, you're in withdrawal when you put it out. Now you have the smoke, you're not in withdrawal anymore. As soon as you put the drink down, you're in withdrawal. Your body wants more. You know, so, I mean, I never went out of the house without a bottle in my pocketbook. And whether it was in a water bottle, wine, I drank all sorts of things. I was a whiskey drinker. And, you know, I was a beer drinker. I was a wine drinker. You know, then I couldn't, then you want to talk about chronic alcoholism. I mean, it was like, if I drank hard alcohol, I would get chronic hives. My whole body would just, like, I was just a big, red, blown up, swollen, itchy. Ugh, it was horrible. And then, you know, I mean, it was horrible. And it was just, you had to look at me just the wrong way. And it would all be, would all start. And once I felt that one first itch, then it was all over. I knew it. And a lot of times I would have to leave work. It was terrible. But if I took more alcohol, it could get worse. If I didn't take any alcohol, it could get worse. I was like, do or die. I didn't know what to do. You know, it was that bad. And, you know, I told everybody it was from shrimp. You know, of course, you know. It couldn't be alcohol. It can't be alcohol. And not until after all of that, I mean, it had went on for years, believe me. And I finally quit drinking. I guess it was for like 2 weeks. And I broke out really bad. So they thought I wasn't coming to the meeting because, I was drinking. And I came the next night, and it was really because I had the hives so bad. And but that was the first time I admitted to myself that it wasn't. I even went to doctors. First time I admitted to myself that it was due to the alcohol that I had hives. And, you know, did I stop drinking? No. Don't get me wrong, I didn't stop drinking, not yet. So, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold this alcoholic people must have depth and weight. So I had to experience it for myself. I had to be willing to say, yes, it was the alcohol. No, yeah, I now experienced it. I now can actually admit it. Alcohol was making me have chronic hives. In nearly all cases, these ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And that's what we're doing. We recreate. We look at our value system. We look at our belief system. We look at, how we treat others, what we're saying to others, and what, some of the things where, like, what we do daily, like in the morning, our routines, all of that kind of stuff, it all becomes a part of our change to recreate this new person, because we have to change all the rules because we can't live the way that we were living before. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. That was another statement that I didn't ever understand. I said, what are they talking about? I know what's true. Well, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. I know for a fact that I would like drive home from work, first things first, try to figure out how much I had at home. Not enough, of course, so I'd have to stop at the liquor store. But I could not. I had to drink it right there. Now, honestly, in my later stages, I would have to throw up after the first shot because my body just couldn't take it. I was so sick. But as soon as that was over, I was on the road again, and I felt okay, and I was good, and now I can. Now I'm ready for the evening. But that's what I had to get to in order for me to even just continue drinking alcohol. I mean, so, but I wasn't sick, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. I mean, that was the other thing. I mean, my mother, warned me, because I was in a profession where, they would have parties and conferences and stuff like that. Don't drink when you go there. So I learned early on not to drink at any professional gatherings, because if I did, I proved it to myself. If I did, all bets off. And most of the time I'd make a mess of things, or I would end up staying over, or I'd have to get a hotel room, or, something. But, after they had succumbed to the desire again, so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. So again, it's like you have a drink, You create the craving, and then you don't drink, and then you consume again, and then the craving. So it's constant. So the only way to alleviate this craving is not to take anything. Abstinence. And the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. There is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessarily being that required to follow a few simple rules, meaning the 12 steps of AA. So this psychic change, as we go along in our program, needs to occur in order for us to stay sober. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I can't go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." I don't know. I know I said, "Doctor, I can't go on like this. I don't know what's wrong with me." Faced with the problem of a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it often is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control, a physical allergy. So, you know, for me, that was another paragraph that I didn't get because, you know, I would take a drink and think that that was going to help me. And what it did was made me not be able to go to the wedding, not be able to show up for work, not be able to show up for whatever engagement that I had. And I don't know about you guys, but, you know, the mental aggression that I would get, because I really didn't want to go to that wedding, I really didn't want to go to that gathering, I didn't, you know, really want to go there, because I couldn't drink there like I wanted to. So, I mean, it was just like I had to go there because I had to go for the family or something like this. Wasn't really my thing. So I really wanted to stay where I was. So then once I started, you know, I would just continue to drink, and then I wouldn't end up going. And then, you know, I never knew, you know, how it really affected people. But I mean, here you go. That really affects people. You don't show up. You know, I have to say, Mike Finley said something in his thing the other day, was when you keep a seat at the family dinner table for the alcoholic. I really related to that, because it's like, that's what my family did. They didn't know if I would show up. They didn't know when I would show up. They didn't know how I'd show up. But they had a seat for me if I showed up. And on the other side of that, it wasn't really that they wanted me to show up, but they still kept me a seat because that was the right thing to do. So that really, you know, that really brought me back to a lot of times when I would have to go to a family dinner or holiday or something, and I know they really, I'd come in, you know, all torn up, ready to go, and they're all looking at me like, here she is, the tornado has entered the room, you know? So anyway, so what time is it? It's 20 after? Okay. So that was the physical allergy. So there are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. This is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are types entirely normal in every aspect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. I'd say they're talking about us right there. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. The immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed, you know? What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to the experience, a man was brought in. Gastric hemorrhage seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. Lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him, there was no hope. Following elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury, which I don't know, like that really brings up, you know, when I first started getting sober, it was like 6 months in, I said, maybe it's time to go to the doctor. Maybe it's time because, you know, any time I had to have blood taken or something like a urine test or, and they would tell me about my, you know, like enzymes or something in my liver or whatever, it would be, you know, well, I'll drink a couple drinks, you know, like they knew, but, you know, so like I just wondered how bad off I really was. I mean, I was surprised by, I was just, I mean, when I quit this past time, I mean, I was just waiting for, you know, liver disease. I mean, I was just, please, just like, you know, I just want to die. I didn't want to be alive anymore at all. I mean, it was over, and I couldn't stand it. That was that jumping off point, you know? And so, you know, when I finally got sober, and it was 6 months, I'm like, okay, so maybe I should go get, like, have like a physical for the first time in my life, to starting to take care of myself, you know, a little bit. And so I did, and I mean, I didn't have any major problems. And, you know, you would have thought that, you know, you could have been close to wet brain. I mean, we were like, I don't know about you, but I was like on my little merry way. I sometimes didn't know what I was doing and what some of the things that I was doing to my body. I mean, it's an amazing thing, this body that God has given to us, to be able to go through all that we did in that self-destructive period. I mean, I was on, you know, that path for so long that I didn't know any better. And we're very lucky. Following the elimination, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. We accepted the plan outlined in his book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. He had taken a total transformation. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. If I grabbed this cup when I was drinking, I had to grab it with two hands, you know. I had to keep my elbows on the ground. If I had to put makeup on, I had to hold my elbow and put the mascara on. I had to have somebody else write my orders because my elbow would just go off. I mean, you know, it was like, and one day I was at work and I grabbed the cup and my manager saw me and the whole thing, like, oh my God, it was all over. You know, like you knew she knew, you know, she definitely knew. I definitely had a problem because, you know, I didn't realize how many times I came into the office. It was loud and boisterous, and I was like ready to go, raring to go, you know. And everybody else is like looking at you, like, "Wow, what happened to her?" Like, you know. And don't get too close, though. I had to be at least 3 feet away from you, maybe more. God, somebody on the train told me how bad I smelled one day, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, I wore, like, huge sunglasses, just so that I didn't have to look, like I could look at you, but you didn't, couldn't look at me. Because you know that the windows of your soul, right? Like you were dying inside. Person looked at me the wrong way, my body would start going in conniptions and I'd start like breaking out in hives. And then the day was shot, man. I would get to work, I'd be bright red, and then I'd have to leave. I'm itching all over. Have to go and use a vino, you know what I mean? Amazing. This has really brought me back a lot of memories, I have to tell you, to share with you. I mean, I've never done a presentation like this, so. So when I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort. Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. And we all know that willpower has nothing to do with this. You know, when I first came around, I thought it was all about morals and willpower, because that's what everybody thought. That's what my family told me. You know, you're a good girl, blah, 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 blah. Had nothing to do with that. I didn't know why, like, that I kept picking up a drink or that I continued when I knew that I shouldn't. Or that, you know, when somebody said, one of the girls I worked with, she was like, oh, yeah, like, two drinks. I'm like, I'm not in control. I'm like, that's like when I like it. Like when I don't feel that, it's like, yeah. So we really have a different relationship with alcohol as opposed to some of the other people that are out there in the world. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that he felt his only hope would be through what we called a moral psychology, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is a fine specimen of manhood, as one would wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book thorough and through. Perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through. And though perhaps he come to scoff, he may remain to pray. Sorry about that. So, you know, I have written here a couple of things. A sick mind can't heal a sick mind. My physical makeup is different. I am an alcoholic. Need to permanently employ this solution for the permanent problem. So, you know, I have so many things that I could, like, share. I will tell you that I went when I came here. My last thing, I lost my job, and I was sitting at the computer. Had been about a month, and I was looking for a job. At the same time, I was drinking, like, I was trying to quit smoking. So I was on Oprah Winfrey's thing of like having a cigarette an hour. And you had to have it, and if you didn't have it, then you lost it. And I'm like, you know, so you're always watching the clock. It was awful. And then I was only trying to drink wine, so I would have only like 4 glasses of wine a day. My ability to drink had lessened. I wasn't able to take in as much as I normally would have. Like, it just changes, I think, throughout the time that your alcoholism is. I used to drink a whole lot. Like, I'd have a fifth, and I'd have this much in it. I couldn't do that anymore. A pint, it was too much. A half a pint I had, but it wasn't enough. Yeah. You know, so it was crazy. So I was looking for a place, because I knew I had a problem. I mean, I knew I had a problem. And but I had no money. I had nobody in my life. I was alone. And but I knew I couldn't take a job. Because you know what? I'm on the merry-go-round again. Every time I get to the same spot, if I don't stop drinking, I'm going to end up here again. So it doesn't matter. Now, I've been to, 6 rehabs? aftercares, I had 2 DWIs, like, okay, tried AA 3 times. I don't know what to do. So I'm looking and looking and looking, and I found this thing. It was called Prometa. And it's for chronic alcoholism and methamphetamine. And I'm like, okay, let me go see these people. So I go and I say, they tell me it's going to be $15,000 or something. I'm like, I don't have any money. Okay, right? Because it's not covered by insurance. So he brings me down to, I'm employed, I need to get a job, blah, 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 you know. And, they give it to me for $5,000. And it's just a series of, it was in Times Magazine, and it's like it straightens out your reflexors or whatever, your brain, A and B, get like all crazy. And I had to try something new. I mean, I tried everything else. I had tried the traditional. I would just have like rehab, a halfway house. So I had to try something different, and that's what I did. It was a 2-week thing. I got a job while I was in the hospital. Amazing. And so now I had a place to go. I had a sponsor that was meeting me after this. So she didn't really know how serious I was, but, I had this treatment. And then 2 weeks later, I told the people I went for the job. I told the people I had to have a drink that morning in order to go to that job interview because, God forbid, I start getting the hives. And made it through. They didn't know, And, then I tell them, okay, they accept me. They have me come in for one more time. Same thing. Still had to have the drink, man. I'm in maintenance plan. And then I get the job, and I say to them, but I have to take off in 2 weeks. I have to go back to this hospital for another injection or something. And that's what I did. And then they told me that you have to continue on a journey with either AA or with a psychologist or a psychiatrist, whatever, counseling, whatever you got to do in order to keep yourself sober, read the books, take the vitamins, all of this kind of stuff in order for you to stay sober. Because it's not just one element. We don't get sober just by coming to this meeting, sitting in here, and voila. Osmosis. We're sober. It takes a village to get us sober. And that's how I got better. And I had nobody. I had to take... you couldn't drive on this stuff. So I had to take a cab on the parkway to this place. And then the last couple of times, I had no money. I said, that's it. It's only 13 minutes away. I'm driving, So I was sick. So sick. So sick. And, I appreciate being able to have shared my story a little bit and the chapter to the doctor's opinion and be able to tell you, some of the things that, occurred in my life, and there's, hundreds more, but it's been a great experience for me up here. Thank you so much.